Hello, Latinos Who Lunch listeners. It's me, Favi Fav, and this week we bring you a very special episode. I'm starting a new podcast, y'all. It's called The Art People Podcast. And as LWL Pod listeners, you get an exclusive first listen before it even airs. You're so lucky. And guess what, Mimi? My first guest was your favorite art historian, baloney connoisseur, and Latinx indie music aficionado. That's right, Babelito. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. Unless you listen to the show when you're driving, make sure you keep your eyes on the road, click it or ticket, okay? We're going to take a little break, and then when we return, it'll be episode one of The Art People Podcast. Calling all Las Vegas art people. Calling all Las Vegas art people. There is a Las Vegas art meetup on November 10th. The Commonfield Las Vegas meetup aims to bring the local Las Vegas arts community together to celebrate the work of arts organizers and to introduce Nevada artists to Commonfield as a resource and connection to a broader field of artist-centric spaces and projects across the country. They also hope to engage in a community-wide conversation co-facilitated by Marcus Sivan, chair of the art department at UNLV, and Aurora Tang, who serves as the CF Council, and Courtney Fink, co-founder of the executive director of Commonfield. Co-organized by Commonfield, Settlers and Nomads, and the Marjorie Barrick Museum of Art, this Saturday, November 10th, from 6 to 9 p.m. RSVP on Facebook. It's free and it's open to the public. Google it, locas. Hi, listeners. Favi Fav again. And another announcement. This Friday, November 9th, here in beautiful Breckenridge, Colorado, where I have been enjoying the snow from inside of my studio, there's going to be a performance by none other than Sancha. You might have heard her on a previous episode. She's going to be here to perform at this event they call Sonic Lodge. Also performing with Sancha is Vic and the Norwals. I think they're going to open up for her. It's going to be a really fun event here in Breckenridge, Colorado, at the Old Masonic Hall, where my show is. If you're in Denver, it's about an hour, hour and a half drive. If you live in Summit County, come on down. It's going to be fun. Also, Rudy Blue Garcia is going to be here. And I heard he may or may not be doing a DJ set. So join us. Hi, I'm Favi Fav, also known as Justin Favela, and this is my new show, The Art People Podcast. It's about art, people. You get it? See what I did there? Okay. Well, some of you may know me from the podcast Latinos Who Lunch. If you don't, that's all right. Let me tell you who I am. I'm an artist and I travel a lot and I get to meet so many interesting people along the way. And on this show, you will not only hear me ramble on about my own work, but you'll also hear conversations I have with artists, including musicians, writers, actors, chefs, educators, creators, and fellow podcasters from around the world. And let's not forget art historians, curators, museum and gallery staff members, art collectors and art lovers that are also just as important when it comes to shaping the art world. I was born and raised in Las Vegas, Nevada, the place that I still call home, and I want to also use this podcast as a platform to highlight the amazing and supportive arts community in Vegas. I love my city, and I love the incredibly talented art people that live there and continue to inspire me. And now, the first official episode with none other than art historian Dr. Emmanuel Ortega Rodriguez, also known as Babelito, my co-host on Latinos Who Lunch. We talk about his career as an art historian, the idea of sentimentality in art, his family, Las Vegas, and much, much more. So now, let's go back in the time machine. Earlier this year, when we recorded this conversation at my Grandma Chavela's house in Las Vegas, because I was house-sitting and that's where my mics were. Okay, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm tired.
That's good. Tired of what?
I've been writing all day, but I'm excited with the product.
What are you writing about?
I'm writing about you.
What are you writing about me?
I'm writing about why or what?
What and then why?
Okay. I am writing about the value of your paper paintings.
Uh-huh.
And their place in history, mm-hmm. in relationship to cultural painting practices in Mexico and the Academy of the 19th Century. And I'm writing it for an exhibition that I'm creating for you at the Berman Museum this upcoming or past September.
Awesome. So how do you like writing about art?
I hate writing. I hate reading. I had all intellectual practices, but the result is always super invigorating. So that's why I'm still doing it.
Why are you an art historian?
I have no clue. It's too late for that question, so I don't ask myself that question.
Okay,
no more.
So you're a baby art historian. You just got your PhD this
Correct.
Past year from the University of New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your PhD in specifically?
My PhD is in Ibero-American colonial art history. What does that mean?
Take it back. Ibero-American. What is that?
That means the colonies of Spain. Ibero referring to the Iberian Peninsula. The colonial, the colonies of Spain in the Americas, more specifically, the territories that now are the southwest of the United States all the way to Chile. But I concentrate on painting practices of the 17th, 18th, and 19th century in central Mexico, because central Mexico was the cultural center of all of those colonies.
Mm.
So you can find actually paintings made in the 17th century all the way in New Mexico or in Colombia. And there's, of course, different artistic centers. You have some in Cartagena. You have some in different parts of the Americas. But Mexico was perhaps the most important cultural production. There was a guild system. There was just so much going on because the idea was not only to construct churches and palaces to make the colonies resemble more like Europe, but also to decorate them.
Mm.
So it was 300 years of an intense cultural production. And that's what I study.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
And what is your favorite part about that time in art history?
Nothing. I mean, the colonial period is fucking oppressive. That's the thing. I feel like when people think that I study colonial art, they think that I romanticize it. And my job is precisely the opposite. I do talk about formal aspects of paintings. I do talk about cultural production. But I also try to show that all these paintings, all these religious paintings that are seemingly boring, they are cultural, they are political propaganda. So I deconstruct the reasons why this is political propaganda and how it works in a very, very oppressive system, where artists were always controlled by the Inquisition, where native artists were not allowed to paint for churches and bigger institutions. It's intense and it's gross. So there's nothing I like about it. The only thing I like about colonial painting per se is how it was a big F you to Europe. So Europe has this big like styles and movements that are being discussed in the academy, and in Mexico it's like this doesn't work here, and the market here is it's different. So for example, mannerism, which was a movement of painting in Italy that lasted 50 years, in Mexico it lasted 200 years. Why? Because it worked. So they were not worried about styles. They were worried about what worked for the purpose of a colonial, you know, state.
So can you give me an example of what some of these paintings would have looked like or the imagery in the paintings?
Yes. So we have, for example, a lot of the production is religious, but a lot of the production is also secular as well. So you go from the first part of the 16th century, there was a period of Renaissance mural practices, and they were at the service of spiritual conquest. So religious groups like the Dominicans that follow the rule of Saint Dominic, the Franciscans that follow the rule of Saint Francis, are decorating all these churches and missions to instruct natives on the good word of God, right?
Hallelujah.
Amen. And the idea is to use the tools of the Renaissance. So the first couple decades of artistic production in Mexico, at least in painting, you have images that look like Il Quattrocento in Italy. They look like images from Florence from that time. Then you have the first influx of Spanish artists that are bringing their styles with them. So the Baroque mannerism, just like it happened in Italy, just like it happened in Spain, just like it happened in the Netherlands, it was also happening in Mexico. But the purpose of Mexican religious painting was for spiritual conquest. By the time we get to the end of the 17th century, Mexican painting looks like nothing you've seen before. Why? Because you have the Renaissance, you have mannerism, you have artists that developed in Mexico that are influencing artists that developed in Mexico. And by the 1690s, the art looks like out of this world. It has a lot of color, influx of light that you don't know where it's coming from. The figures look like Rubens, but they're extended like if they come from the Mannerist period. A lot of contrast in, like, for example, there's a famous painting of Villalpando in the Cathedral of Puebla called El Diluvio. Mm-hmm. And that painting has been used to show how unique Mexico was in terms of religious painting. It's just an explosion of light, color, form, that if you want to place it in the history of the canon, in the canon of art history, it just doesn't belong anywhere except for Mexico. Mm. And then after that, you get more European type of painting in the 18th century. By the time we get to the 19th century, Mexico is just another colony for neoclassicism. So the same thing that has happened in France, England, Italy, the United States is also happening in Mexico.
So, okay, Renaissance. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? You said, okay, there's a few terms that you said. Renaissance, mm-hmm. Mannerism, Rubenism?
Well, there's... Rubens was commissioned by people in Mexico to make altarpieces in Mexico. Mm-hmm. So he has a huge influence in Mexico. You can actually still go to Mexico and see a couple of Rubens that were painted for Mexican audiences. So Rubens and other Netherlandish and other Northern European artists had a huge influence. Mannerism just refers to a style of painting that happens between the Baroque period, the 1600s, and Renaissance, which is like, I think it ended with the death of Raphael in 1540-something.
Okay, so I'm more of a visual person. So mm-hmm. visually, what's the difference between a Mannerist painting and a Renaissance painting?
So Mannerism, you have to put it in a historical context, and the Renaissance brings together clarity, right? All the paintings of Michelangelo and Raphael, they're easy to read.
They're soft,
is right?
Is it soft?
Yes, it's very soft, baby.
How soft is it?
The paintings of the Renaissance are like the triangular composition, very easy to read, to understand. And they blend ideas of classical Europe, mm-hmm. Rome and Greece, with religion. By the time we get to Mannerism, people are like, what the fuck is this? This is like heresy. So there's a period of confusion where people are trying to make sense of what's happening. And that reflects in Mannerist painting that the colors, as scholars refer to, are cangianti, where you have like almost neon reds next to blues and just make no sense.
Are they darker?
They are brighter.
They're brighter.
Because they're not trying to resemble nature like in the Renaissance. Instead, the figures are super elongated. Sometimes there's no shadow. Sometimes there's shadows. It's not about naturalism. It's about to stretch the limits of formalism. So bodies are stretched, light is stretched, color is stretched, form, everything is stretched to a point where it's actually for a lot of art historians is more commanding to do artists from the Mannerist period, because you need to understand naturalism and then you shape it into whatever the fuck you wanted to do. So Mannerism, it's the antithesis of Renaissance, and the Baroque is trying to bring back a lot of the ideas that were lost during the Mannerist period. So you have to think of Mexico as that. It's a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
So when I explained Mexican colonial painting in my classes, it's very complicated because we are so entrenched in this idea of the European nomenclature. So it's like, is this Renaissance? Is this Mannerist? Like, yes and no. We don't have the vocabulary. And for that reason, a lot of people don't pay attention to these movements of art. It's just till recently, especially in the past 5 years, that the Louvre did an exhibition of Mexican colonial painting. LACMA had a huge show on 18th century painting that went to the Metropolitan Museum and it won all kinds of awards, because now people are starting to understand Mexican painting as something completely different than anything European, as opposed to bad copies of
an extension
Velázquez or an extension of that. Yes.
Interesting.
It's super fascinating, because when you first approach a painting from the late 1600s, your first reaction is like, this is ugly. What the fuck is this, right? But when you separate yourself from those hierarchies, which brings me back to your essay, when you don't think about high art, low art, popular art, academic art, and you approach it according to its historical context, you realize how valuable and how amazing and how unique it is, which is what I was saying about your paintings, that you use quote-unquote popular techniques to make a commentary on academic paintings. So when you separate and you divorce all of that vocabulary, what you get is your own product, which you're doing is very unique, and it's also very important.
It's very important.
Very.
Very, very important. Okay, so I am interested in also asking you about the classroom, because I know you were an adjunct professor at UNLV.
Yes.
And you're leaving Las Vegas.
I am. Las Vegas. My last couple of days here.
Las Vegas is losing one of its only art historians that is a person of color, and you're leaving to Chicago. Why are you leaving?
Because I'm getting paid almost three times as much for working half as much, and I'm allowed room to create my own methodology through my classes.
Damn.
So I am developing a whole new way of approaching Mexican art, and it's going to take me a couple years. But I'm going to be able to do this in the classroom.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay, where are you going?
I'm going to the University of Illinois at Chicago. And I'm going to teach my first grad seminar. And I'm going to make them read a lot of sentimentalist novels and all kinds of crazy 19th century romantic stuff that is going to help me redefine what Mexican art is. Visual culture in general.
And what do you want it to be defined as?
You know, when you look at a soap opera today, right? It's like super melodramatic.
A soap opera?
Yes.
Yeah, I don't really watch them, but...
Okay, but you've seen soap operas.
Yes.
And they're fucking dramatic, right?
Yes.
You've listened to a song of Juan Gabriel.
Yes.
You've listened to José José.
Yes.
Okay, it's super dramatic, right?
Yeah.
Have you seen movies from the 1940s and 50s? I know you have.
Yeah.
Okay, just how dramatic. There's like this drama.
There's a lot of pauses.
Yes, and there's a lot of drama to our visual culture. So that didn't make sense to me. The way that I learned history also didn't make sense to me, because it's very romantic. And it's not till I learned the history of sentimentality in the United States and how white people have framed slavery and emancipation that I started to understand that something similar was happening in Mexico. So the conquest started to be viewed as this romantic encounter of two cultures, which we still see it like that. A lot of things that happened throughout Mexican history were framed under that umbrella. So my job is to use those tools of American art or US art and adapt them to Mexican art that is going to help understand everything. Paintings of the conquest all the way to Rosa Salvaje, 1980s Mexican soap opera, because it's all under the veil of sentimentality. And it's a task. It might take me years, but if I have a goal in life, it's that it. It's to write my book on sentimentality in
Mexico. What is sentimentality for people that don't know?
Sentimentality is when you approach anything, when you approach a poem to the idea of the nation, to a painting, through feelings.
Mm.
And the idea is to create feelings of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And we know the work of empathy is an antithesis of action, meaning that because you feel bad or you feel good about something, you don't actually act upon it.
Mm-hmm.
So think about, for example, right now, all the things that are happening with our immigrant kids and how they're detained in the border.
Yeah.
So we see all those sentimental views of them crying in TV. We look at that, we feel like shit, we cry, and then boom, somehow we feel better. Like we are, in a way, redeemed through our feelings. Mm-hmm. Instead of like...
taking action.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And sentimentality and empathy precisely do that. And that's what the nation wanted you to do. They wanted to wanted you to feel sentimental, wanted you to feel empathy for the creation of the nation. The mestizo ideal of the early 20th century. Just there's like a lot of layers to sentimentality that I need to like deconstruct, you know.
I know that you work here in the States, but you also work in Mexico. You're yes. part of the board of Arquetopia, mm-hmm. Which is a foundation in Puebla mm-hmm. that has an artist residency program, a gallery, several different programs.
Several.
And is there a difference when you work in Mexico versus the United States on how people look at your research and what you're talking about?
Yes. And it's always, they always put a wall. Because I'm seen as a Chicano.
Oh, yes. You're seen as a Chicano.
A Chicano or
because
Northern.
You were born in the States.
And because I work here.
Yeah.
So first they denied they don't take me seriously. So for example, in Puebla, it took me years, not necessarily through Arquetopia, because they always believe in what I did, but like presenting my work in the museo, for example. Mm-hmm. Like who is this kid from the States coming to do an exhibition about martyrs in this convent, for example. Mm-hmm. So I had to do a presentation after a presentation. By the second, third presentation, I started to see the same people coming back. And I started to see a group that understood what I was doing. So it took me years to gain their trust. When I first presented in the Universidad Autónoma de México, which is like the Harvard of Mexico, there was a little bit of, ¿cómo se dice? Resistance. Uh-huh. Because why is this kid from Las Vegas going to tell us about the conquest of Mexico, right? And the art of like the most important artist of the 19th century, which is José María Velasco. So I remember presenting on that day and I was shaking because I knew this was coming. And people were standing up in the room because at the time that I presented, they closed one of the halls. So everybody was supposed to be in the same hall. Like people didn't fit in the room. I was like, of course, this is during my presentation. Mm. And my bibliography had their hands raised to ask me questions. I was freaking out. And I was in a way fighting them because I presented 19th century artists this sentimental fallacy, you know, like propaganda, political propaganda, and they didn't like that. Mm. There's a lot of resistance. So it depends. Now I feel like I'm a little bit more established, so I have more room, but there's still resistance because they have the resources, they have the archives. But in the States, we're trained with a lot of theory. So I feel like we go with our theory and present our findings, and they don't necessarily like it because they're not necessarily tied to their findings through their archives and the actual material culture because they get to see it every day. Like in an ideal world, Mexican art historians should be always working with U.S. art historians. And when they do, which is something that Los Angeles County Museum has been able to do successfully, mm-hmm. the results are fucking fascinating, man. I was just in a symposium that organized by Elona Katsu in Los Angeles County Museum. That shit was mind-blowing. And it was in the same panel you had people from Colombia, from Puebla, from Harvard, like everywhere. And the results were amazing. So, yeah, I went on a tangent, but whatever.
That's fine. So what have you learned from teaching here in Las Vegas from your students?
I love the students in Las Vegas. They have a different approach and perspective to art. For example, I've learned a lot about the importance and the connections we have with our Philippine brothers and sisters.
Filipinos.
That's right. There's a lot of similarities.
Like our cousins.
They are our cousins. Yeah. Yes.
I wouldn't say brothers and sisters, but cousins for sure.
Yeah, especially culturally.
First cousins.
El primeros primos. Uh-huh. Is that a thing? I don't know.
Primos hermanos.
Primos hermanos.
Yeah.
That's what we are. And I've had students who make sense of the discrimination within their own families through Mexican art.
Yeah.
And that to me is amazing. One of my best students, Nagar, shout out. She wrote an essay that she's developing for grad school that she's looking at the way that mezquitas or the way that iguans or the way that Muslim palaces and temples are red from bottom to top. And like, and she is applying that way of vision, that epistemology, into reading Mexican churches.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, for example, when you look at a...
literally the architecture of a Mexican church.
Yeah. So, one of the principles of 17th and 18th century architecture in church architecture in Mexico is the altar facade. So, whatever you see on the outside, it's a preview of what you see on the inside. So, the facades are elaborate, super, super elaborate. And everything is about decoration. Everything is about the awe. Everything is very Baroque. Like, your eye doesn't know where to go and it never rests. So when I explain it like that, like a zigzag, a pattern of zigzag that your eye goes back and forth, up and down, left to right. And she's like, no, like understanding the Muslim traditions in Mexico and the way they affected people in the 16th century, they continue to the 18th century. And this is how this type of facade should be read. Like, that's a fucking dissertation. That's a fucking book that nobody is doing. And the way she did it and deconstructed it is beautiful. Those are the kind of nuances that only in a place like Las Vegas and or UNLV that has such diverse, student body you'll get, because you won't get that in fancy universities where it's mostly Caucasian students. Like, you're gonna get that with when you have different epistemologies and different ways of seeing and understanding the world come together through Mexican art.
Caucasian.
Well, but
what a word.
See the whites.
I like saying white.
White.
White. Anglo. Do you know the distinction between those?
Nope.
Me neither. So, yeah, I don't care about white people. So let's see. What else should we talk about? I want to know, like, what are you consuming now, like, as far as art? And it doesn't have to be fine art, you know, like visually, maybe musically. Like, what are you listening to? And does that tie into your practice as an art historian?
Again, I'm an anti-intellectual, meaning... I'm always looking for rooms where to not engage critically with things, because I'm always engaging critically with things. So if I find something that allows me not to think, it makes me very happy. So in terms of TV, I'm about to finish this series on this 80s Mexican singer, which actually was the most successful Latin American singer in history, more than Ricky Martin. His name was Luis Miguel.
Oh, yeah. He dated Mariah Carey.
Right?
Duh. We all know who he is.
Yes. So yeah. His dad was an asshole. So the whole show...
Relatable content.
The whole entire show is about what a dickhead he was.
His dad or Luis Miguel?
No, his dad. His dad stole millions
and
millions.
Was he a producer on the show?
The dad died.
But was Luis Miguel the producer of the show?
Of course. But it's almost like common knowledge, because people have ideas. His mom disappears. I'm about to find out what happened to her. His dad died mysteriously of some disease. Now we know what happened, or we have an idea of what happened. Luis Miguel has been performing since he was like 7. And now we get the story behind how he was obligated to do all this shit. It reminded me a little bit of seeing that documentary on Amy Winehouse.
Oh.
Or how the dad was pushing her to perform when she was just like, she's going from plane to performance, performance to plane, y drogada in between.
Yeah.
In a way, I mean, not as extreme, because the whole thing with Amy Winehouse happened in a couple of years. Think about that, but stretched in a period of like 20 years. Mm. And it's una tras otra, it's like one after the other. Bitch, it's so good. And it's in Telemundo Online, so I'm just like watching it for free now.
Nice.
That's what I did last night. It's so good. So I engage with shit like that.
Yeah.
In terms of music, in the past couple years, since we started Latinos Who Lunch, I'm all about independent Latin American music.
Yeah.
So right now I'm listening to Balloon, a band from Brooklyn.
Yes.
It's like Dominican, via Brooklyn, Puerto Rican,
Caribbean.
And also Mula, who just came out with a new song today. And Mula from the Dominican Republic.
I love that band.
Bitch, that new song.
I love both of them.
Fire. Yeah, Mula. Both of them are amazing.
Yeah.
But like, there's a lot of reappropriation of Caribbean music right now and even U.S. music mainstream. But listening to these kids who grew up with this music and the type of things they're doing with reggaeton, with bachata, with all these new movements of music, it's super exciting. It's super exciting. And so that's kind of what I'm listening to mostly. A lot of things in Spanish.
Yeah.
And which is unlike me. Like, I'm all about indie rock in the U.S. But in a way, there's less and less more prominent bands that I respect in the U.S. But I mean, that's because just, you know, music is changing a lot. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I also want to get into a little bit about your family and what they think about you as an art historian. Because I know that with a lot of Latinos, I mean, we've had these conversations before within the Latinx community. And actually, really, the art world is very, it's kind of like this really inexplicable, like, world where people really don't know how anything works. Yeah. And then once you figure out how to navigate through the art world, you're like, oh man, this shit is all bullshit.
Yeah.
So,
Oh my God, yes.
And I know that applies to art history and like academia.
Yeah.
But how do you, first, let's talk about that, but let's start with talking about like, how do you explain to your family what you do?
You know, I've been so lucky where my parents never ask anything from us.
Mm-hmm.
So going to college was a personal decision. It wasn't a collective pressure from my family. So the solely fact that I made it all the way to a PhD program and graduated, being the first PhD on both sides of my family, that's all my parents care about. My parents always supported me in that presentation that I told you in UNAM that I was fucking shaking. I was able to breathe when I saw my dad coming in the room.
Oh, that's nice.
My dad may not engage academically or intellectually with what I do, but he understands that it's important to me. So every time I have a presentation, you saw them in Denver when I presented my dissertation.
Yeah.
They're always there. They're going to go back to Denver when I present in November. So they're always good. My dad is the one who's more curious, especially when it comes to religious images, because my unacceptance of the canon, meaning everything from art to religion, comes from his hippie spirit, you know? So every time I talk about the image of the Virgen de Guadalupe, he's like, I want to know more. Pero espérate que se vaya tu mamá. Like, I cannot engage with my mother like that because my mom is like more religious, you know?
Yeah.
So always accepting, never questioning, not necessarily engaging, but that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. What was the second part of the question?
Okay, so you got your undergraduate degree in what?
In UNLV, in art history.
And then you got your master's at UNM?
Yes.
Again, in art history.
Also
with a focus on
colonial painting.
And then you got your PhD?
Yes.
Okay, so then what's the process? Then you're looking for a job.
Yes.
But you were already teaching when you had your master's.
Yeah, because Kathy Kelly, Dr. Kathy Kelly, rest in peace. I took a lot of undergrad classes with her. She was my unofficial mentor at UNLV.
Mm-hmm.
And right before she died, she goes, you need to come here. You need to teach here. And this was 3 months before she died.
I loved her.
She was amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember explaining what I do to her. She was so excited. She was so, so excited. She goes, you have to teach a class here. You have to teach a class here. And she passed away. And then 6 months later, I think the following semester, I came in to fill in some of the classes, the Baroque and so on. And it's almost like she knew. It's almost like she knew. So that was her legacy.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of Baroque classes in UNLV. But I also was allowed to teach my own stuff, which is the Mexican stuff. That was back in 2012.
Mm.
I think it was my first semester. So I've been adjunct since 2012. When you get your PhD, you have to take classes, and then after the classes, you have to take your exams. And once you take your exams, you become a candidate. So by the time I moved back to Vegas, I was already a candidate. Once you're a candidate, they give you up to 10 years to finish.
Okay. So that's for you to do your research. Basically, write a book, right?
Basically, yes.
That's what you have to do to get your PhD. Yeah. What was your book about?
My dissertation. Oof. Do we have time?
I mean, just tell me the title of it.
I don't even remember the fucking... I haven't looked at that thing in a year.
What was it about in a nutshell?
Okay, so I look at portraits of Franciscans. Again, the Franciscans being the followers of St. Francis, who first came here in the conquest in the 1500s.
From Italy?
From Italy, yes. Uh-huh. But they're Franciscans all over Europe. So they come from Spain. And the Franciscans that come here, they started to develop their own history of how great they were because they were expanding their religion and because they're conquering, spiritually conquering the world. So the construction of their history starts in 1519, and it's done through images and through books. The fervent activity of the Franciscans in the 1500s dies in the 1600s. And in 1680, the pueblos of New Mexico revolted, or they organized a revolution against the Spanish. Kicked out the Spanish for 16 years. That freaked the fuck out of the Spanish.
Oh, shit.
So then after 1696, you have all this... Again, all this activity for missions, to create missions. So you have more missions in New Mexico, California, Texas. And the missions that were being constructed and the way they were conducting business and the art that they were making about themselves and the books they were writing about themselves is very similar to the 16th century. So what I do is that I look at a painting that must have been done in 1740, 1760. And what I do is I look at the painting and then I look at the history of that person that was portrayed in that painting. And then I look at the documents that were used to write the history. So there's a thread between the documents, the books, and the painting. And at the end, by looking at the different thread, I start to read between the lines. And what that information tells me is that they're trying to show this positive things about themselves and negative things about Native Americans. So the construction of Native Americans as lazy, as barbarians, as naked, as drunk, has been constructed in Mexico for a long time. By the time you get to those paintings that I study, it's already almost like common knowledge, even though it's all invented. So in a way, the stereotypes that Native Americans have in this country, they owe it to the fucking Franciscans. So I look into that history. It's a lot of boring and tedious work because just to look at that whole history of one martyr, you have to write a lot of unnecessary shit. But when you start deconstructing the silences of history, as Michael Trillo called it, because he says...
Michael Trillo.
He wrote Silence of the Past. And this is an amazing book that I have everybody reading. I've read it like 4 times. And in the book, he talks about how history is nothing but a series of silences. So like something happens, like we're recording this right now. Mm-hmm. This is truth. This is fact. This is happening.
Facts are facts, America.
Right. So then you, after this, you're going to go for dinner with your tía or whatever. Uh-huh. You tell your tía about what happened here.
Yeah.
So between what happens right now and what you tell your tía, there's going to be some information that you're going to lose. Yeah. And of course, your tía may not want to know everything about us. So you're going to choose the information you want to tell your tía. Mm-hmm. So those decisions create a silence. And then from there, your tía in 10 years is going to write a book about your life and talk about this precise moment that you talked to her about at dinner.
It's going to be boiled down to one sentence.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so all of that creates another silence. So I have to look at the documents, at the books, at the literature, at the paintings, and how the way that we get all the way to the final product, which is the portrait, it's nothing but a series of silences. So my job... in both my dissertation and hopefully on my book on sentimentality is to deconstruct silences. I read that book 6-7 years ago and I still refer to it as my favorite book. So amazing.
I mean, you told me at the beginning of the interview that you don't like to read or write, but it seems like you're really excited about what you're talking about.
Because once you get into it,
yeah.
Because I want to know. So, I mean, I hate doing it. but I want to know. So that's why I do what I do, because it pushes me to write and to read. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I will just watch Luis Miguel over and over again.
What have you read anything for fun lately?
I haven't read anything for fun since 2006. The last book
you look
I wrote,
so sad when you said
I
that.
I do, because I used to love Latin American novels, and I used to eat them up. All that magic realist bullshit made in Colombia and all that shit I loved. And I used to read, one of the last books I read was a 700 pages novel by José Donoso, El Obsceno Pájaro de la Noche, The Obscene Bird of the Night. And I remember I read it in like a month. I just I was so into it. And I used to love to do that since high school. I haven't done that.
Were you brought up Catholic?
Ish. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I did my first communion, but I never did my confirmation or anything like that. But casual Catholic, yes.
You know, I was just doing an installation in Portland, Maine, and like halfway through it, I'm like, damn, why do I do this? Like, I hate doing this. Like, physically, it hurts my body.
Yeah.
But I keep doing it. And every time that I do an installation, it's like, it's more complicated. And I have to like be on more ladders and just like really like
push your
limits. Push my limits.
Yeah.
And I say I don't like doing it, but why do I keep doing it? You know what I mean? And a lot of that, I think, has to do with my religious upbringing.
Really?
And I think that my upbringing really emphasized a value on suffering. And if you don't suffer doing something, it's not valuable. It's not valuable, and it's not for the Lord, or, you know.
Yeah.
There's that episode of The Simpsons that I will never forget, because the words that the nuns were singing to the children, like, just resonated in my head. They were singing, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. You know that song? But they were going, if you're happy and you know it, it's a sin. If you're happy and you know it, it's a sin. You know? Uh-huh. Like, happiness and, like, just being complacent is seen as a sin a lot of times.
Yes.
So, I don't know. I just talked about myself a lot, but whenever you say that, it reminds me of that.
No, and you're absolutely right. For example, I remember when I was writing my dissertation, my dad is like, ay, qué padre. Like, you go to coffee shops and like you're just like drinking coffee and that's your job. And I remember feeling guilty. I'm like, there's no pain. Because, yes, I mean, it's very fucking...
And the next time you went to the coffee shop, you sat on a chair with nails.
Con martillos y la chingada. Yeah. I remember feeling guilty. I'm like, my dad works from sun to sun, right? And like this fucking heat.
Yeah.
Like for 30 years, just like feeding us all. And here I am sitting down in my fucking laptop in like fucking hipster coffee shops. I felt guilty. And if it wasn't until I came back to New Mexico to finish writing my dissertation, and they said, in the scheme of things, writing is the most difficult job. And this is why. And when they explained that, I was like, oh my God. Okay. So now I feel redeemed a little bit, because writing is fucking horrible. I just spent... What is it? 4 or 5 hours working on an essay that I've been working on for the past couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like working on this sentence for 20 minutes and being like, I fucking hate this. I fucking hate this. And then right before I came here, Lo Leí Una Vez Más, I read it one more time. And I remember feeling like I was coming, man. Like I was just fucking so excited and happy.
Like,
so
you were what? Excuse me.
It's a pleasure that I cannot compare to anything. So it's like, okay, this is why I do what I'm doing. Like,
okay, here's a napkin.
But those sort of values that you're talking about, those Catholic values of redemption and pain and suffering, they go into what we do. And again, at the end of the day, I fucking hate reading and I fucking hate writing. But here we are. I mean, that's just how shit works, you know?
Speaking of how shit works, you know...
Don't talk about my poop again, because you love to do that.
I'm not. People can listen to Latinos Who Lunch. If you want to hear me talking about Emmanuel's poop, listen to Latinos Who Lunch, because my goal is to bring it up every episode from now until the end of the podcast. Now, speaking of how things work, I've been in a lot of shows now in different institutions, and it's hard to shake some of the experiences we have as people of color in these places. And I mean, I'm pretty light skinned. I'm white passing. You're a little darker than me. But still, we have male privilege, cis male privilege. And we have to kind of work within these confines of these white supremacist, patriarchal corporate institutions.
Yeah.
And even if they say they're nonprofit, it's like, yeah, bitch, the NFL is also a nonprofit, but they still work like a corporation. You know what I mean? So, how do you navigate through those spaces? Like, do you have any experiences or maybe some advice for any, some young aspiring art historians that are having a hard time, like, knocking down those white walls?
I've been lucky to start looking for a job in the era of political correctness and people realizing the need for diversity, even though sometimes that's under their own terms. So I truly believe that I was hired as a token Latino in the new institution.
In Chicago?
Yeah.
That's
and
good.
I also felt, I feel like they don't know what's coming, which is good. But well, I also know how to stand my ground. I was trained by some badass women. Shout out Kirsten. But I also have, as you say, like male cis privilege. I haven't navigated the art museum world like you have. And I've been there front row to see that, to see your experience. And in a way, I use it as a teaching tool. What's happened to you has come to me, to my classroom all the time.
Yeah.
So it's allowing me to learn not only for hopefully the next project that we may do together, but maybe something when I have to do it for myself. The university setting and the museum setting, it's a business at the end of the day. And you need to know your stance. And sometimes that takes years. Some people are trained and they know exactly where they stand. It's very complicated, but you have to approach as a form of resistance. Because the second you don't, you become one of them and you're going to play into their games and you're not going to make any difference.
That's something that I have to keep reminding myself, is that I'm not one of them, because from day one of being like just conscious of the racism in this country as a 5-year-old, that's the first thing you're taught. Assimilate, be quiet, and don't ruffle any feathers. You know what I mean?
Right.
So now, thankfully, you know, through the podcast that we do, Latinos Who Lunch, now hopefully through this podcast, it gives me a clear idea of what my identity is, because a lot of it has been erased.
Correct.
By this quote unquote melting pot of a country that we're part of, you know? A lot of times I think these institutions, hire the token Latino or token person of color, but don't really listen to them. They're just there. And it's just kind of understood. You know what I mean?
And that's why I hate the word diversity.
Yeah.
Because what diversity means to us doesn't mean to the same to them.
Yeah.
And understanding how that diversity is going to work in the place where you're that token, I think is the key to being successful in navigating that space.
Yeah. And I think that's what the point I was getting at is, like, how do you know when you're that person that was hired to disrupt what's going on? Or how do you become, because we've seen it time and time again, these people are hired and then they're fired and they hire somebody else that's a little more submissive or whatever. Like, how do you figure that out? I guess you just have to try
to become the token.
Yeah.
And, but again, like we said with a lot of our listeners, you also have to be strategic, and that's important. Sometimes you just have to give up, but always with the idea that you're going to gain more power at some point and things are going to be navigated according to your own terms. Sometimes that takes time. Sometimes people are able to plantarse from the beginning, you know, as like, this is who I am, this is how I'm resisting, you better deal with it, bitches. Some people can afford that, some people can't. It's taking me a while, and I mean, I know this upcoming opportunity is gonna be interesting. Part of me feels like it's gonna be very successful, and part of me is like, nope, it's not gonna work out. But that's good, it's part of the process, and hopefully I'll get to the point where I'm going to get to the institution that it's been waiting for me this whole time and that I've been waiting for. And I'm going to find it. But I mean, it takes time.
So what is your goal as an art historian? What do you want your legacy to be?
To write my book on sentimentality.
Oh, yeah, we already talked about that.
As of now, it's that. I want to be able to show that our visual culture is complicated, our visual culture is sophisticated, and our visual culture is painful. And I feel like through this new methodology that may not be called sentimentality, then I could make something different. I feel like people are going to start seeing Mexican art not as a colorful, exotic thing, but it's a very nuanced and complicated thing, just like every other country, you know?
So yeah.
That's my goal.
Well, Las Vegas is going to miss you, dude. Would you come back? Like, yes. What would you say if they offered you a job at UNLV right now that was comparable to what you're going to get paid at in Chicago?
My family, my student, and the students are worth it. Yeah. Maybe the politics of a department is not, but every department has its politics and they're all fucked up, right?
Yeah.
So there's certain things that are not worth coming to Vegas at all to me for many, many reasons, personal and professional. But at the end of the day, it's about the students and it's about my family. Mm-hmm. So if they match or they get close and then I have the bonus of my students and my family, there's no way I can say no.
Yeah.
And Vegas, it's so interesting because I remember doing an internship in Venice in the Peggy Guggenheim for a month. And I was the exotic token Mexican from Vegas. They couldn't understand that notion. Like, how come you're from Vegas? Like, what's there? There's no culture. There's no art. And I feel like, in a way, my career is proof that you can do whatever the fuck you want from wherever you want to. So when I see those kids that want to go to grad school, so when I see those artists that are looking at you, for example, as an example of what they can accomplish without having to sacrifice moving somewhere else, those are the people that I want to teach. Mm. Of course, LA is a dream for me because it's filled with Chicano students that I would love to teach. And there's other places that I would love to teach. But having to dismantle that idea of the periphery and the center with my students and saying, I also came from this school and I got my PhD and I got the job.
Yeah.
For them to see that, which is something that I didn't see, I think it's very, very, very valuable. So if I can offer that to students in UNLV in the future, I will do it in a heartbeat.
You heard it here first.
Marcus, are you listening?
I'm going to edit that out. So we have a weekly podcast called Latinos Who Lunch. And on that podcast, we talk about whatever we want. And we had a very honest conversation right now. So people are like, how honest can they get?
Oh, this is nothing.
But this is nothing. So just for all you folks that are listening now, if you want to hear myself, Justin Favela, a.k.a. Favi Fav, and
Pavelito, Emmanuel Ortega.
Dr. Emmanuel Ortega. Mm-hmm. We have a new podcast every Thursday, and it's called Latinos Who Lunch, as I mentioned. You can go to latinoswholunch.com to check that out. And just to give people a taste, I just want to talk to you about something we would talk about in Latinos Who Lunch. And this is code switching for all you white people that don't know what that is because you've never had to do it in your life because this world was made for you.
Yeah.
Okay, girl, let's talk about something that I've had it on my mind for a long time.
Sácalo.
What do you feel when you're like surrounded by a lot of white people in the space and somebody knows how to speak Spanish, and then because you're the token brown person, they come up to you and start flexing their Spanish on you and just speaking to you in Spanish?
I fucking hate it.
Oh my God. I want to punch people in the fucking head.
Right.
They, as soon as they see me, their eyes light up and they can't wait to tell me about their trip to Guatemala and how they learn how to speak Spanish and how beautiful it is over there. And then I'm like,
trip to Guatemala.
Whatever, wherever they go, summer. Yeah. Okay.
Like, and oh my God, I've been to Cancun. I'm like, I have not been to Cancun.
Oh my God, I'm ruining South America. Like, okay, thank you. this is just a message to all the people.
Yes.
I speak English, we're in a predominantly like English speaking space right now. You don't need to flex your Spanish on me, bitch.
You don't need to show off. the harder you try, the more I'm gonna hate you.
Yes.
And that's true to, you know, for a lot of things. But when people are just like casually start talking about, I don't know, fucking Mexico, just because it happened to be part of the conversation. All right, let's do it. I love to talk about Mexico. I fucking get paid to talk about Mexico. Pero when they're like, oh, he's Mexican, I'm going to practice my Spanish with him. Fuck you.
I charge for that.
Fuck you.
There's a difference. And I have been in situations where people speak Spanish. Or like, for example, here's a great example. There's an okay way for this to happen naturally. Mm-hmm. So I was doing this project in Portland, Maine, and one of the interns was from Spain.
Yeah.
So shout out to Luisa. Luisa and I were speaking Spanish back and forth once in a while. Mm-hmm. Just when it was like, you know, I speak Spanish when it's faster to speak Spanish, and I know he understands what I'm saying.
Cuando se te atoran las palabras.
Yeah, so we were just going back and forth here and there. The curator is a white lady. Shout out to Elizabeth. And she knows how to speak Spanish too, because she took it in high school. Or whatever. And just naturally we were talking, and then Elizabeth would respond in Spanish, but we were already speaking in Spanish.
Yeah.
So we were just like, oh, stunning, great.
Yeah.
Like, this is great. But she didn't like straight up like, oh, like I was there for 3 weeks and she didn't speak Spanish to me. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
There, I mean, you can do that. And that's fine.
And some of the instances are just natural,
But that was a natural conversational way of doing it, you know?
One time when I was working in this French company, this guy's like, you're from Mexico? Oh my God, I love Mark Anthony.
Yes, bitch.
Right. Right.
Oh my gosh. So I was just like,
no. Yeah, I don't like it. I absolutely hate it.
I've been meaning to bring this up on Latinos for Lunch.
We need to.
I just thought about it right now.
We need to write a fake letter.
We'll do a whole episode about it.
Yes.
Okay, back to Art People Podcast.
Back.
Well, you know, I like to end every... Actually, I don't know how I like to end every podcast, because this is technically the first episode. Uh-huh. But maybe, just maybe, I'll end it by asking people, what should I ask you?
That's a good question. we already talked about favorite book or artist. No, you cannot ask.
Maybe I'll ask you... I probably already asked you this, but I'll do it again. Like, what would you say to a young art historian today? What would be your number one piece of advice?
To work with the intention of deconstructing silences, not to be part of the canon. Because if you're working to become an art historian, like the canon has dictated, you might make money, but at the long run, your art may not have, your work may not have as much value. If you work with the purpose of deconstructing silences that are at the end going to explain a lot of the things that are happening today, then I think you just need to go do it. I remember one of the first times I took a class with Kirsten, she asked me, what is your audience? And I said to her, oh, it's like these academics from Mexico City. Like, I was focused on apantallar, how do you say it? On prove myself.
Proving yourself.
That I could be an art historian from the United States and is successful in Mexico. And it was like 2 years later where I was like, you know what? No, none of that shit matters. My audience is my family. And having that realization made my practice more ethical, my writing more responsible, and the end goal of my career more anchored on my students. It took me a long time. So do not lose yourself. It's so easy. It's so easy to lose yourself in the facade of the glamour, because sometimes the art world may offer that, you know, like openings and having your book and your book party and the conferences and meeting fancy people and shit. That's nothing. That means absolutely nothing. That's just shit that you have to do. Focus on the important things of deconstructing silences. They could be your own silences, or they could be the silences of a culture. That's all I have to say.
Dr. Emmanuel Ortega Rodriguez, muchísimas gracias, amigo.
Thank you so much.
You can follow Dr. Ortega on Instagram at Babelito and on Twitter at Babelito666. You can listen to new episodes of Latinos Who Lunch every Thursday on latinoswholunch.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you heard, please make sure to rate and review the show. Follow us on social media at ArtPeoplePod and visit our website, artpeoplepod.com. Today's episode was produced by me, Justin Favela, and Sarah Vick, with music by Mike McDonald, graphic design and photos by Crystal Ramirez. Okay, that's it. Bye-bye.